We're also a not-for-profit, so that's a big part of our mission, along with our choice to participate in social justice work.
My name is Rip Van Wagner from the lovely village of Catskill, and you're listening to WGXC ACRA, Catskill and More, 90.7 FM.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Greene, and Southern Albany counties with digital cable, high-speed internet, and cable phone services for homes and businesses since 1971. Mid-Hudson Cable, all the right connections on the web at mhcable.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Glen Falls House in Round Top, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about Creative Community Radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
White supremacy should also be on trial at Trump's impeachment. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. The nation is reliving the violent January 6th attack in the U.S. Capitol as Democratic Congress members deliver a devastating case against Donald Trump in the ex-president's historic second Senate impeachment trial. These nine House managers have assembled video and other evidence detailing Trump's months-long campaign of lies, claiming the 2020 election was stolen, and his consistent encouragement of violence leading up to the Capitol attack. Their case has been methodical and comprehensive, but leaves largely untouched a fundamental feature of the insurrection, white supremacy. Even if at least 67 senators vote to convict Trump for the single charge of incitement of insurrection, and more than half vote to ban him from ever again holding public federal office, this trial will not advance the struggle in this country to overcome systemic racism. The U.S. Capitol would be an appropriate location to launch an anti-racist movement. Soaring rhetoric has filled the hallowed halls for more than two centuries, extolling liberty, freedom, justice, and equality. Yet, as we were reminded Wednesday by Congresswoman Stacey Plaskett, the delegate representing the U.S. Virgin Islands, one of the House impeachment managers,
this Capitol that was conceived by our founding fathers, that was built by slaves.
Throughout the videos of the Trump-incited mob rampaging through the building, many with Confederate and Nazi flags and other white supremacist symbols, we catch glimpses of the famous rotunda, the crypt beneath it, and Statuary Hall. Each of the 50 states sends two statues to the Capitol, and they're placed throughout the complex, as Statuary Hall can only accommodate 35 of them. Of the 22 statues from the 11 Confederate states, at least 15 were slave owners, and 10 of those remaining were Confederate officers or officials. Last June, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi sent a letter to the Joint Committee on the Library, which manages Statuary Hall, asking that statues of Confederates be removed. The law, however, requires the states that sent the statues to approve any removal or replacement. Virginia agreed and removed its statue of General Robert E. Lee, leader of the Confederate Army. A statue of African-American student organizer Barbara Johns will be put in its place. As a teen, Johns organized a strike at her high school protesting the wretched conditions of her segregated school. A legal case followed, becoming part of the landmark Brown v. Board of Education Supreme Court decision outlawing segregation in public schools.
And it took the Civil War for slavery to end. Of course, a Civil War that was between the Union and the Confederate States of America. In the Confederate States of America, the vice president of the Confederates was, of course, Alexander Stevens, who, last I checked, has a statue in Statuary Hall. And Alexander Stevens, I believe in 1862, said that this Confederacy is founded on the great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man, and slavery subordination to the superior race is his natural and normal condition.
That's Professor Ibram X. Kendi speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour. It's not just dead Confederates in the Capitol. North Carolina honors Charles Brantley Aycock, who was just a child during the Civil War. He devoted his life to white supremacy. He was a lead organizer of the Wilmington Massacre of 1898, when a white mob of 2,000 armed racists attacked the elected biracial local government, destroyed businesses, including the only black-owned daily newspaper in the country, and killed between 60 and 300 black residents. Aycock's punishment? He was elected governor of North Carolina, then pushed through laws that disenfranchised African Americans. There are also many statues honoring so-called founding fathers who were slave owners, among them George Washington and Northerners Jonathan Trumbull of Connecticut and George Clinton, the first governor of New York. History professors Kendi and Keisha Blaine have just published a remarkable anthology titled 400 Souls, A Community History of African America, 1619 to 2019. It brings together 80 prominent African American writers, scholars, and activists, each of whom contributed an essay covering a five-year span from those 400 years of African American history.
We were really thinking about how do we connect past to the present.
That's Professor Blaine explaining the book on Democracy Now!
Helps us contextualize the history and to see some of the challenges that remain even to this day, to see how it connects to the period of slavery.
After Trump's racist supporters with their Confederate flags were cleared from the Capitol, leaving five dead and over 140 police officers injured, the National Guard moved in. Several African-American soldiers posed for a photo with one of the Capitol's newest statues, that of Rosa Parks. These memorials matter. The Senate should convict ex-President Donald Trump. But the root causes of the insurrection, racism and white supremacy that Trump has embraced and exploited his whole life, will require far more work to overcome. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
90.7 FM.
Accra, Hudson, Catskill.
Welcome to Clubhouse Radio, live from the Catskill Youth Clubhouse on 90.7 FM, WGXC, broadcasting Acre, Catskill, and Hudson. That song was... I'm sorry, what song was that, Lincoln?
It's Ooh Child by the Five Steppers, I think.
Hey, thank you. Stay tuned for some more great music discussion and more. We're going to kick off our show after the local news and weather.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC Daily News. I'm Philip Grant. Bernadette Hogan, Carl Campanelle, and Bruce Golding report in the New York Post that one of Governor Andrew Cuomo's top aides, Melissa DeRosa, apologized to other Democratic lawmakers on an audio recording about the state's handling of COVID-19 deaths in nursing homes. DeRosa said that in August, as President Donald Trump threatened a Department of Justice investigation, and I quote, "we froze," end quote, out of fear that the true numbers would, and I quote, "be used against us," end quote, by federal prosecutors. While some Republicans quickly went to, and I quote, "impeach Cuomo," end quote, after reading the story, it does not say much new. Since long before August, many Democrats and Republicans have criticized how the Cuomo administration seemed to manipulate the reporting of COVID-19 deaths between nursing homes and hospitals. DeRosa's audio admission does not address all that, saying instead, and I quote, "because then we were in a position where we weren't sure if what we were going to give to the Department of Justice or what we give to you guys, what we start saying, was going to be used against us, while we weren't sure if there was going to be an investigation," end quote. Cuomo's administration is known for rare apologies, and DeRosa offered one on the recording. She said, and I quote, "so we do apologize," end quote. She went on to say, and I quote, "I do understand the position that you were put in. I know that it is not fair. It was not our intention to put you in that political position with the Republicans," end quote. Last month, Attorney General Letitia James released a damning report estimating that the deaths of nursing home residents in hospitals would boost the total nursing home death tally by more than 50%. Health Commissioner Howard Zucker then released figures showing the total for New York COVID-19 nursing home deaths was 12,743 as of January 19th, up from 8,711 deaths New York officials previously acknowledged. And you can read more about that story in the New York Post. Natasha Vaughn and Aaliyah Snyder are reporting for Columbia Green Media. Former Hudson Police Commissioner and Chatham Police Chief Peter Volkman pleaded guilty February 11th to illegally collecting nearly $93,000 from the Village of Chatham and the state pension system. Volkman, 57, a resident of Stuyvesant, was arraigned on charges filed by the New York State Police following an investigation by the State Comptroller's Office, Columbia County District Attorney's Office, and the New York State Police. Volkman pleaded guilty to taking state and local pension funds in the amount of $74,222 and $18,607 from the village by falsifying mileage vouchers and other reimbursements. Chatham Mayor John Howe said the plea effectively terminates Volkman's tenure as an officer and as a chief of police. He must also pay restitution in the amount of $92,829. State Comptroller Thomas DiNapoli said in a statement, and I quote, "instead of upholding the law, Volkman, the chief law enforcement officer of the village, defrauded the state's retirement system and his community," end quote. He went on to say taxpayers have the right to expect their public officials, including law enforcement officials, will act with honesty and integrity, end quote. Volkman was arraigned on various charges, including two counts of public corruption, second-degree corrupting of the government, and second-degree grand larceny. He pleaded guilty to one count of fourth-degree grand larceny and official misconduct. Columbia County Assistant District Attorney Ryan Carty said he was arraigned in Columbia County Court under Superior Court information. DiNapoli's office said Volkman was double-dipping the state pension system. Carty said, and I quote, "as a result of acts of omission, Mr. Volkman was able to steal $74,222 from the New York state pension system," end quote. According to DiNapoli, he hid public source income from 19 municipalities and school districts in excess of the statutory limit by funneling the earnings through a private business. House said financial irregularities involving Volkman came to light in a routine village review in February 2020. Volkman was placed on administrative leave from the Chatham Police Department last September after the village was served with a search warrant related to the investigation. The chief was suspended from all duties at that time. And you can read the full story at HudsonValley360.com. Nick Reisman is reporting for State of Politics. New York lawmakers this week introduced a bill intended to block state and local governments from providing resources or personnel to federal immigration enforcement officials. The measure would also bar the disclosure of information deemed sensitive to federal immigration officials as well. State Senator Julia Salazar said, and I quote, "We cannot allow for our state and local governments to be complicit in the systematic abuse that ICE inflicts on our communities, including preventing people from accessing essential services. This is why it's urgent that we pass New York for All, our legislation that will prohibit New York's local and state law enforcement agencies from conspiring with ICE," end quote. Lawmakers previously approved, and Governor Andrew M. Cuomo signed into law, a bill that bars federal immigration officers from courthouses in New York. The push to restrict the federal government's immigration enforcement efforts were heightened during President Donald Trump's term. But lawmakers, as well as advocates who support the measure, point to ongoing concerns and mistrust within the immigrant community. Read the full story at NewYorkStateOfPolitics.com. Amelia Teasdale is reporting for the Columbia paper. The Chatham Village Board voted unanimously in February in a February 8th online meeting to pass a local law eliminating the village court and the position of village judge. The court will remain open until early April when the term of the current judge, James Borgia Foster, expires. The village board held a public hearing on the local law before the board's regular meeting. One resident, Lyle Locke, a former village board member, asked why the board planned to close the court and whether it was for financial reasons. Mayor John Howe said the court was previously sustained by the revenues it brought in, but in recent years, court finances have been, and I quote, "pretty much a wash," end quote. However, as of last year, and I quote, "we were in the red," end quote. In 2020, the court was forced to shut down due to the pandemic, resulting in no revenue from court activity. In addition to the cost of the court, the mayor said the village paid two police officers to be at the court when cases were being heard. Tickets and other court issues in the village will now go to the town courts in Chatham and Ghent. Part of the village is located in the town of Chatham and part in the town of Ghent. Of the four villages in Columbia County, only Kinderhook and Philmont still have their own courts. And you can read the full story in the Columbia paper. And that wraps up the WGXC Daily News. For local weather reports, public meetings, community information, or COVID-19 updates, visit our website at WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Graham. Have a good day and a nice weekend.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Friday, February 12th. Brr, it is 1 degree in Hubble Corners, and the warmest point on my map is Kingston, coming in at 11 degrees early this morning. The mercury will jump to 22 by 2 p.m. Winds will be light, but coupled with the temperature can still be a problem. Bundle up if going outside. Overnight temperatures fall back to around 9 degrees by dawn tomorrow. Then a high of 25 makes it very similar to today. That is until dark, when the snow returns to our area. An inch or so is expected to fall by dawn on Sunday. And on Sunday, snow will be light all day, but should only leave a negligible accumulation. Today's tide schedule is high at 3:17 a.m., low at 9:42 a.m., high again at 3:34 p.m., and low again at 10:14 p.m. Sunset today will be at 5:09 p.m. and sunrise tomorrow will be at 6:51 a.m. Looking way up, we see three near-Earth objects are expected today, the largest of which is 31 meters wide. Solar wind speed is currently 323 kilometers per second at 7 protons per milliliter. The 24-hour predicted KP index is 1. Quiet. There have been 8 days since the last sunspot. And this has been The Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Maker Syndicate.
You were just listening to an we're going to play an original Clubhouse theme song by the Trax Music Program.
Here's what we do at the clubhouse. It be fun at the clubhouse. Music stay loud at the clubhouse. Staff be cool at the clubhouse. Not just mine, just your house. Music program at the clubhouse. Got a drum set at the clubhouse. Got a piano at the clubhouse. Make your own beats at the clubhouse. Get on the video at the clubhouse. Share your voice at the clubhouse. Express yourself at the clubhouse. Trax program at the clubhouse. Be yourself at the clubhouse. No judgment at the clubhouse. No drama at the clubhouse. We accept you at the clubhouse. Got field trips at the clubhouse. Got art supplies at the clubhouse. Creativity at the clubhouse. Paint your own wall at the clubhouse. Got a TV at the clubhouse. Got Wi-Fi at the clubhouse. Food and snacks at the clubhouse. Hope to see you at the clubhouse.
You were just listening to an original Clubhouse theme song made in our Trax Music Program. Welcome back to Clubhouse Radio. So today on the show, we have myself, Imani.
DJ Ricky.
Mari the guest.
And we have another guest on Skype, if you want to unmute yourself real quick.
Dr.
That good?
Yeah. You're good.
Right.
We can hear you.
Oh. So, that's Dr. Eric. And today we're just going to be asking each other a few questions. So, do you know, like, what made you become a doctor?
Yeah. So, first, I guess I'll just sort of briefly just give you guys a little introduction. I am a resident, so that basically means I've graduated medical school, and I'm training right now in a residency program to become like a fully licensed physician. So basically what that means is I'm still in my training. I'm not fully licensed, and I'm about halfway through my residency. At the end of my residency, I'll be a fully licensed physician. My specialty right now is internal medicine, and we can talk a little bit about what that is, what that means, if you guys have questions about it. In terms of why I went to medical school, I think my whole life I've really just been interested in science. When I was in high school, I read this book called The Hot Zone. It's about this virus called the Ebola virus. You guys have probably heard of it.
Yeah.
It's a very lethal virus that was first documented in Ebola, which used to be a country it's a river in Africa. And I don't know if you guys remember, a few years ago, there was some cases in the United States, and it was very scary. And that really got me interested in viruses. When I went to college, I studied biologic engineering, and I did research in a virology lab. So I studied viruses in a laboratory setting. And I really liked the work I was doing. The physician who led the lab, she was a doctor too, and really just inspired me to continue on a path towards medicine. And when I, you know, got to medical school, I had many different interests. At some point, I wanted to do neurology. At some point, I wanted to do infectious diseases. And then eventually, I decided to do my residency in internal medicine, and I plan to specialize in oncology, which is cancer.
Mm-hmm.
That's really amazing.
Wow. So, how long did you have to go to school for that?
Yeah, so it's a long time. You have to go to college, so that's 4 years. After college, I actually took some time off to do research, which is a pretty common thing for people who go to medical school. When I went to medical school, it was my class had a very diverse group of people from all over the world who did all sorts of different things before they went to medical school. Some people went straight from college to medical school. Some people had careers before they decided to come back to medical school. So, you know, for me, I was at the end of college deciding between whether or not I wanted to be a doctor or be a scientist or mm-hmm. do both. And I think by the time I took that time to do research full time. And for me, I really wanted to, work with patients in a clinical setting. And it inspired me to continue to go to medical school. So medical school is 4 years. And then after you graduate medical school, you have to do a residency. Mm-hmm. So residencies, there's many different ones. There's surgery, there's internal medicine, which I'm doing. And there's all different types of different residencies. But basically, it's a time after medical school where you train in a hospital under what are called attending physicians or senior physicians. And residency is usually, depending on what you do, it could be 3 years and it could be as long as 7 years. After residency, if you want to specialize, it's another few more years. So for me, for instance, internal medicine is a very broad field. It encompasses a lot of subspecialties like cardiology, which is, you know, heart doctors. What I want to do is oncology, so a cancer doctor, gastroenterology, doctors who treat stomach and intestinal illnesses. So once you finish residency, you do what's called a fellowship, where you specialize in your specific area. So for me, you know, if you add it all up together, it was 4 years of college, 4 years of medical school, 3 years of residency, and then 3 years of fellowship. So what is that? 14 years of education and training?
Wow. Yeah, I think, yeah. Sir? Yeah.
Yeah.
Was the amount of time you had to spend kind of stressful for you?
Yes and no. I think I like learning a lot, and I was always, you know, everything I was doing was always very interesting and stimulating. And, it is very difficult. College is hard. Getting into medical school is hard. Medical school is hard. Residency is even harder. But if it's something that you're interested in and you like, it's one of the most fulfilling things I think anyone can do. So, it takes a long time, but there's a reason it takes a long time. And you learn so much and you get to work with so many interesting people, meaning not only the doctors you work with and your coworkers and colleagues, but your patients. You meet some of the most interesting people in the hospital. You meet some of the most interesting people in your clinic who you treat. And it's a truly rewarding experience. And, it's a huge honor to be able to do what I do. And I'm really, you know, glad I'm doing it. It's certainly not for everybody, but if it's something that is for you, I couldn't recommend it higher. The rewards are so much greater than, you know, the sacrifices you make, in my opinion. But I'm still early in training, so talk to me in 10 or 20 years.
All right. Mario, you had a question?
What does a typical day at work look like?
Sure. So it's, you know, my training right now is primarily hospital-based. So hospital hours are early and long. We do many different rotations. So, you know, what we would call the general medicine floors, meaning taking care of patients who are in the hospital for many different reasons. A typical day for me would be, you know, go in very early. So typically I'll be in the hospital around 6:30 in the morning. I review how my patients did overnight. I check all their vital informations, meaning, you know, their blood pressure, their heart rate, if they had a fever. I look at laboratory tests. So we get laboratory tests every morning for different reasons for patients. Mm-hmm. I make sure all of those look normal. And then we go and see the patients, and we wake them up, unfortunately. We ask them how they're doing, how they feel. And once we've seen all the patients, we meet as a medical team, meaning residents and attending physicians and medical students too. We talk about all the patients and we talk about what the plans are for the day. And then, you know, there's a lot of work to be done during the day, calling different other doctors to see if they have any input into patients, making sure they get all their medications, and tending to any needs that the patients have during the day. Typically, the day will end around 5 o'clock, but it could go very late. Sometimes, you know, people are sick, things come up, and you have to tend to some, you know, urgent situations. But, you know, go home. I try to relax when I get home and go to bed early.
That's cool.
Describe a time when you felt discouraged from being in the medical health field.
Sure. let me think of an appropriate one for you guys. I think, you know, something that's very difficult and was very discouraging for me is, and you know, it happens more frequently, it happens not too frequently, but it does happen, is, you know, sometimes, you know, you have very sick people in the hospital and you work very hard to help them, and sometimes they, you know, don't necessarily want to be in the hospital. And, you know, it often leads to difficult situations where you have patients who you work very hard caring for. And not that they don't appreciate it, because they usually do, but sometimes they just want to leave the hospital for different reasons. And you have to, it can be very discouraging when they just want to, you know, reject some of the care you're trying to give. And, you know, it's a balance between recognizing somebody's autonomy and their own choices for, you know, their own healthcare and their own body. And, you know, you as a provider wanting to do the best, what you think is the best for them. And sometimes we're wrong and the patient knows themselves the best. And sometimes we try our best to make sure that, you know, we're doing the best for them. But sometimes that's not what everybody, you know, staying in the hospital is not in line with everybody's goals. I think, you know, to make a long story short, when, you know, patients don't want your care and you know they're very sick and you want to treat them, but they don't want to be treated. And that does happen, and sometimes you just have to respect people's autonomy and what they want for themselves.
So, have you gotten any patients that have COVID or has had COVID?
Yeah. So, in March, you know, this has been a very long year for everybody.
You don't really remember the months like that. Yeah. They just all blend together.
Exactly. So I don't know if you guys remember what March was like, but New York City, which is where I'm based, was hit very hard. And New York City was sort of the epicenter for the COVID-19 pandemic in the United States during March. So, you know, this is going to sound scary, but it's, you know, the truth of what I experienced. Every single patient in our hospital was COVID, was a COVID patient in March. Scary. We have, I don't know exactly how many beds we have. I think like 800, something like that, maybe less, 600. But almost every single patient was COVID positive. And certainly every patient I was taking care of was COVID positive. And, you know, I worked on the general medical floors, and I also worked in the ICUs. So, you know, for about a month straight, certainly for the first 2 weeks in April, last week in March, we were just treating only COVID patients. The beginning was very scary for us because we had no idea what this disease was, and we had no treatment, and it was really scary to just walk into the room and see people struggling for air and struggling to breathe, and us as doctors and nurses not being able to do much to help them. And that was an extremely frustrating and difficult experience for all of us, because, you know, we treat a lot of very sick people a lot. I've spent a lot of time in ICUs, and ICUs are full of, you know, it's only the most sickest people in the hospital. And oftentimes, you know, we know why people are sick and we know how to treat them, or at least we have treatments. And COVID, we didn't have treatments. And it was just watching people either get better or, unfortunately, sometimes get worse. And it was, you know, a very humbling experience. We felt there were times where we felt very powerless, and that, you know, we had no control over the situation. Sometimes the best thing we could do was just be at their bedside and talk them through their pain, and, you know, talk to their family members. And it was an extremely difficult experience. But it was, on the other hand, it was, you know, in ways inspiring to see all of my colleagues and all of the nurses, you know, sacrificing so much to give so much of themselves to help these people, even though we knew we weren't doing all that much because we didn't know that much.
All right. I think we have time for one more question before we go to news, and then we'll come back with one more question.
Sure.
We have more questions.
Have you been diagnosed with COVID yet or at all?
So, yes. I actually had it very early in March. I got sick, and this was around the time there were a lot of cases. There were very few cases, and we didn't even have testing. So I had all the symptoms. I was quarantined from work for a period of days. My symptoms were very mild. I had a fever for a day, and I was tired for a day, and I actually did lose my sense of smell and my sense of taste, which is fairly common for this virus. And there was no testing at that time, and I got my antibodies tested like a month later, and I was positive. So even though I didn't have the PCR testing, that tests for the active virus, you know, I had all the symptoms, and my antibodies came back positive a month later. So I think so, but and I'm pretty sure, but, you know, I don't have the PCR test to prove it.
All right. So now we're going to go off with our local news and weather.
We will be right back.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. I'm Philip Grant. The Times Union is reporting Governor Andrew M. Cuomo's Secretary Melissa DeRosa told state lawmakers in a conference call on February 10th that the administration's protracted refusal to release full data on COVID-19 deaths of nursing home residents was due to the belief that they were facing a politically motivated probe by former President Donald J. Trump's Justice Department. The disclosure prompted fresh demands from lawmakers in both parties for a full investigation of Cuomo's stonewalling and possible obstruction of a federal request, as well as calls from Republicans for the governor's resignation or impeachment. In the meeting, DeRosa explained why Cuomo's team rejected the legislature's request for the complete data a month after the state health department released a self-exonerating report concluding that Cuomo's March order that care facilities could not turn away COVID-positive residents did not play a significant role in the virus's devastating spread through many of those facilities. That report, however, only counted deaths of residents at the facilities and not the deaths of those who were shifted to hospitals and then died. In a statement February 12th, DeRosa said her comments were taken out of context. She said, and I quote, "We were comprehensive and transparent in our responses to the DOJ and then had to immediately focus our resources on the second wave and vaccine rollout. As I said on the call with legislators, we could not fulfill their request as quickly as anyone would have liked. But we are committed to being better partners going forward as we share the same goal of keeping New Yorkers as healthy as possible during the pandemic," end quote. But in the meeting, DeRosa made it clear that the administration viewed the federal inquiry as a political attack. DeRosa apologized to the lawmakers for the political pressure placed on them by the administration's refusal to provide the data. Republican State Senator Jim Tedesco said in a statement DeRosa's admission was shocking. And I quote, "Rather than apologize for the cover-up and any role the Cuomo administration may have played in the deaths of 15,000 New Yorkers from the coronavirus in nursing homes, Ms. DeRosa instead gave a mea culpa for putting the Democratic legislators in an inconvenient political position," end quote. Other critical comments were posted on social media from Democrats, including Assemblymember Uli New and State Senator Julia Salazar. Assemblymember John McDonnell issued a more conciliatory statement. He said, and I quote, "I am committed to getting answers to the many outstanding questions and discerning the facts we need to make informed decisions on next steps. Anyone who lost a loved one in a nursing home deserves these answers, and my colleagues and I are committed to ensuring full transparency on this issue," end quote. Read the full story in the Times Union. Aaliyah Snyder is reporting for Columbia Green Media. The Galvin Foundation housing developments planned for North 7th Avenue and Upper State Street on Hudson's north side do not have on-site parking, leading to an ongoing conversation about where future residents will park. As a result, the foundation will conduct another depot district parking assessment after criticism of its initial study, which cited the number of available parking spaces for one night only. Although the plans for the depot district to minimize on-site parking is in accordance with the Hudson Comprehensive Plan, there is no on-site parking to be provided for 138 new units in the area, raising the question, where will everyone park? At a meeting of the city planning board this week, Dan Kent, Galvin Foundation Vice President of Initiatives, mentioned that renting spaces from the city's Columbia Street Municipal Lot and One Hudson City Center were possible options. The foundation hired Mark Nadalny of Crichton Manning Engineering, LLP, to conduct a traffic and parking study to assess where residents of the planned buildings would park. Galvin has now asked Crichton Manning Engineering to conduct a follow-up assessment based on feedback from the planning board and the Hudson Fire Department, Kent said. Kent wrote, and I quote, "We are now in the process of identifying creative solutions for off-street parking, which include an assessment of available parking in the vicinity of the project site," end quote. The planning board agreed to begin the public hearing process March 9th. Kent said, "The results of the follow-up parking study and detailed parking recommendations will be completed in time for the hearing." And you can read the full story at HudsonValley360.com. State and local election officials are reminding voters that the party change deadline statewide is Sunday, February 14th. But because the 14th is a Sunday, the effective deadline is Friday, February 12th. Any voter that wants to change their party enrollment in time to vote in a 2021 primary or caucus must submit a change of enrollment form to the Board of Elections no later than close of business on the 12th. Note, if an enrollment change form is submitted at the DMV, it is not enough to submit that change form at the DMV by Friday. The change must be forwarded by the DMV and received at the Board of Elections by the 12th. The primary elections will be held on June 22nd, so an enrollment change received after the February deadline will become effective on June 29th, 1 week after the primary. Due to COVID-19 restrictions, the Columbia County Board of Elections asked that voters, and I quote, "attempt to do election-related businesses by phone, mail, or email," end quote. The board can be reached by phone at 518-828-3115 or via email at elections@columbiacountyny.com. The Greene County Board of Elections can be reached at 518-719-3550 or via email at elections@discovergreen.com. And that wraps up the WGXC News Update. For local weather reports, public meetings, community information, or COVID-19 updates, visit our website at WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a nice weekend.
Okay, clubhouse, it's the fun house, it's the best house, bit of a mess house, no stress house, we joke around, or can be serious, so come here being versus or delirious, we don't make fun of, we don't bully, don't pull on the back a nobody hoodie, accept everybody the way they are, just facts, cause every time we sign in we make a pact. Cause it's the clubhouse, it's the fun house, it's the best house, bit of a mess house, no stress house. We follow the rules, community guidelines too, so nobody here acting a fool. We got radio, we got tracks, then we hit the art room and relax. Now we about to hit a throwback. Don't hog that remote, Bubba. You better give me the remote. Give me the remote, Bubba. Cause it's the clubhouse, it's the fun house, it's the best house, bit of a mess house, no stress house. In this house make nobody feel inferior, cause anyone can have a great interior. Yo, we special, yo, we cool, so come on down and be a part of the clubhouse crew. I'm out.
That was an original clubhouse theme song by one of our clubhouse guests.
DJ AJ.
But welcome back to the Clubhouse Radio. All views expressed on Clubhouse Radio are our truth and may not represent the views and opinions of the Clubhouse Parent Organization and the Mental Health Association in Green of Green County. So on the guests on Skype, we have a guest, Mr. Eric. So we have a few more questions for you.
Sure.
So what impact did the speed of vaccines coming out have on safety?
That's a great question. I think it's a concern that a lot of people have had. I think what people don't realize is that, you know, this vaccine technology, the mRNA vaccine technology, has actually been in development and has been researched for almost 20 years already. So the company BioNTech, who partnered with Pfizer to make their vaccine, they've been studying various different mRNA vaccines for a few years already. And Moderna, the other company that made the mRNA, the other mRNA vaccine that's available, has also been studying these vaccines for a few years. So yes, they did come very fast, but the technology had been in development for about 10 to 20 years already. So they already had some information that these vaccines would be safe. Now, what about the vaccine for specifically coronavirus?
Yeah.
So the way the mRNA vaccine works is it's basically like instructions that tell your cell to produce a protein. So when you get vaccinated with the mRNA vaccine, this molecule called mRNA is basically is instructions, like a script, for your cells to make proteins, which your cells do all the time continuously. And it tells your cells to make a protein that the virus expresses called the spike protein. Once your cells make the spike protein, it stimulates an immune response against that protein, which is how traditional vaccines work. So a lot of traditional vaccines are either they take the virus and they weaken it so it doesn't infect you, or they take a protein from the virus and inject it into you to stimulate an immune response, meaning it tells your white blood cells that are in charge of fighting off and recognizing things that don't belong in your body. It tells them this protein is foreign. It's an invader. If you ever see it again, attack whatever has this protein on it. So basically, you know, the vaccine that we have is two technologies that have sort of been around for a long time. Traditional vaccines have been around for hundreds of years, and the mRNA technology has been in research for 10 to 20 years. So it sort of combines the two concepts, two technologies that have been around for a while, and puts them into one vaccine. So, you know, the mRNA, this is the first mRNA vaccine to be approved. And I think, you know, people should definitely think critically about it and think, oh, this came very fast. Usually vaccines and medications take a long time to be developed. Why should this be safe? And it's something that, you know, in my opinion, it is safe based on a lot of what the data that's been published by these companies. They've studied it in tens of thousands of people, and they've studied it over the course of, albeit a short course, you know, 6 months at this point. They've been studying it, and there haven't been major side effects seen yet. And, you know, I think when you think about something like a vaccination, you have to weigh the risks and the benefits. You know, for me, And for what I tell my patients, it's, you know, I think the risk of getting a COVID vaccine, the infection far is much more of a concern for me. And I'm much more concerned about my patients getting the COVID infection than I am about a risk of some side effect from the vaccine, which hasn't been established yet.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a great question. I think it's a really important question. And it's something that you need to think critically about, speak with, you know, doctors about it. And I totally understand, you know, the sentiment that the general public has that this came very fast. But, you know, the reality is this is technology that's been researched and in development for many more years than people realize.
Do you have a favorite part about being a doctor?
Yeah, I like a lot of it. You know, hands down, you know, my favorite part is when you have a patient who comes to the hospital and they're very sick and you find out what's wrong with them and you're able to treat it and you get to see them go home to their family. For me, watching them leave the hospital healthy and in a much better state than they came in is, you know, one of the best experiences.
Mm-hmm. That's cool.
Dope.
Describe a time when you felt like a hero.
That's a difficult question because, you know, being a doctor, you know, being a resident, you know, it's your job. It's your job to take care of people. It's your job to treat sick people. So I don't oftentimes, feel like, you know, I'm a hero because, you know, this is what I've wanted to do my whole life. And it's a privilege that I'm allowed to, you know, of course I'm allowed because I've trained and gone to school, but it's still a privilege that I get to work in a great hospital. I get to work with great doctors and great nurses and great staff, and I get to work with amazing patients. And, you know, like I said, watching people leave the hospital is its own reward. But I will say I did have an experience recently now that I think about it. Mm-hmm. I had an older woman who came in during COVID, and she was very sick, and we were very worried she would have to go to the ICU. But she did well, and she got to leave the hospital. And months later, I got an email from a nurse from a different hospital saying she saw my name on a patient's chart and found my email and emailed me thanking me for taking great care of her mom. And for that to have come from a nurse who had also gone through so many hardships during COVID-19, that she appreciated what me and my team were able to do for her mom, was truly a special thing for me. And it was very emotional to get that thanks from her.
Yeah. That, like, my coach, her mother is very sick. That's what that reminds me of. Like, because she just got COVID a little while ago.
Mm-hmm.
And she actually did end up going somewhere. And, like, she was spending some time in the hospital, too. So that makes me think of that. Yeah, me too. She is getting better, actually.
That's great.
She's doing better.
Another last question.
No. Do you have a question?
Yeah. What's your experience of getting the COVID vaccine?
Sure. So I got it like the week it came out, because they were great in my hospital, and I think generally in New York City in the hospitals about getting it to their frontline workers very quickly. So I got mine almost 2 months now already. I you know, I'll be honest, after the first shot, I think because I had had a prior infection, the next day I had, my arm was sore and I felt a little bit tired.